The tour content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions.
Okay, so this is a special methodology here called Of Wolves, Men, and Methodology, an attempt to capture and articulate an epistemological upheaval, right? And brief refresher, epistemology is the study of how we know what we know, or basically a theory of knowledge. And so an epistemological upheaval is when you lose your sense of what it is that you can know and not know, and it creates anxiety and then change, okay? And I mentioned in the, when I announced this, that either, so I'm going to, I had a major like upheaval, and I'm going to attempt to convey it verbally, but it stems from a book. And it's kind of like when you see a movie that you love and you're trying to like tell your friend about it and you're very excited. So sometimes like the excitement is contagious and then that makes them want to see it. And sometimes you just come across as like a raving lunatic and like they can't relate to your excitement. And so I'm going to try to convey this. And like, I hope that I can translate some of this into something that's useful for you. But if not, I'll just come across as someone who's just raving about wolves and knowledge. Okay. So the book is called Of Wolves and Men by Barry Lopez. Here's the physical copy here. So it's not a very long book. You can see all of the pages I bent down. I found out it's so sad when you read a great book and you want to email the author and then you find out that they just died. Like he just died 2 months ago. And I was going to email him a bunch of questions, but very sad. The book was written in 1978, which is quite a while ago now. But apparently it still is considered a like groundbreaking book on wolves. And it was a finalist in the National Book Awards in 1980 for general nonfiction. So we're talking here, like, this is not some obscure like wildlife book. This is like an award-winning book for nonfiction, like in that year. Okay. And, I got to talk about the table of contents. Okay. So the book is really four books. And you could even read them as four books if you're only interested in one. So, it starts off with an introduction. Then section one is a scientific, or biological, treatise on what we know about wolves. Okay. From a scientific perspective. Number two is from an anthropological perspective in the sense of he studies Eskimos who have lived with wolves and other tribes that have lived with wolves for a very long time and tries to get their perspective on it, okay, and like how they lived in harmony with wolves. Part three is all about wolf hunting, okay? And like if you see this chapter nine, An American Pogrom, as a Jew, I feel like you're like, oh, don't use the word pogrom lightly. But it really is insane how like mass human-led just hunting wolves and just killing wolves that have just decimated species and like for no good reason, like, you know, his pogrom word is somewhat warranted. And then this last part is one that I was the least interested, but I could see someone being very interested in, is a complete survey of everything ever written about wolves. From like scientific literature, like going back from like the first writings about wolves to myth to like history of Red Riding Hood to like, you know, superstition, a complete survey. Then he has an epilogue on the raising of wolves and a new ethology where he talks about his experiences raising two wolves, which he said he regrets doing. And he says if he could go back and undo it, he would undo it. But he said that he learned a lot from wolves, about wolves from that, but he also realizes it's his own perspective. And then he had an afterword, which he wrote in the 2000s to like update it based on what we've learned. Okay. So these are the sections of the book. So it's a very, very diverse book. Now, here's how I would characterize it. If you've spent enough time talking to me or like reading my blog, you'll see that one of the books I always recommend, one of the best books, is The Gift of Fire by Richard Mitchell. So in the very beginning of his book, he has a description of his own book, which he says, "This is, I'm afraid, a presumptuous book. It is a book about how to live by a man who doesn't know how to live, but who has begun to learn that he doesn't know how." And I would describe Of Wolves and Men as a book about wolves by a man who doesn't know about wolves, but who has begun to learn that he doesn't know. Okay. And if this is the type of thing which I'm not going to be able to let me state the purpose again, then I'll say what I can't convey. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a list of what I'm calling lupine fallacies and biases. Okay. So these are He doesn't identify these like in explicit terms, but what I went through is I combed through the entire book and tried to get the 15 mistakes that people make about wolves. So I'm going to show you excerpts from this book, and we're going to identify the fallacies. Then we're going to go to the Rabag on in his Hakdama about Torah, and then explore how these fallacies are present in even stronger forms in our knowledge of Torah. Okay. And then like talk about remedies. Okay. So these are excerpts drawn throughout the entire book, and they're not in order. And like I culled what I thought was useful. And there was a lot more than this, but I wanted to fit it into like a 1 hour thing. So, okay. So first thing is, I wish I could show you the dozens of places where he says statements like this, but these are just a few quotes. Throughout the book, he says stuff like, "We know painfully little about wolves. We can only ask the questions and guess. I am not an authority on wolves. It is hard to conceive of another animal. I don't think there is one that has suffered such prejudice as an object of our scientific curiosity." What I'm saying is this: we don't know very much at all about animals. So almost like every section of his book where he goes into in-depth scientific knowledge and like huge amounts of bakius, and like, it's just this striking intellectual humility of realizing that we barely know anything about wolves at all. Okay. And I wish I could convey that to you, but like, it's like on every page. Okay. So mistake number one, and this is the classical mistake, this is, you know, Socrates identifying the one mistake, is overestimating our knowledge / underestimating our ignorance. And that's obviously true in any area, but right now we're going to talk about it in relation to wolves. Okay. So this is fallacy number one, or bias number one. Okay. And we're going to speed through this really fast, but feel free to like ask me questions either about what he's saying or the implications, but we're really going to kind of hold off on discussing implications until we go through the 15. So feel free to ask them, but I might like delay the answer until we talk about Torah. Okay. Two. So the author states his thesis in the intro, and he says like this. First, he gives his an explanation of, or he sets the stage in terms of his knowledge of wolves. And I just included one paragraph to just show you like how much he was involved. "I've looked for a wolf different from that ordinarily given us in the course of learning about animals. I've watched captive wolves in Barrow, Alaska, in St. Louis and Nova Scotia. I drove across the Dakotas and Montana and Wyoming, speaking with old men who killed wolves for a living when they were young. In New York, I read in libraries in the Piermont Morgan what men thought of wolves hundreds of years ago. I read in the archives of historical societies of outlaw wolves and Indians. I went out with field biologists in Minnesota and Alaska and spoke with Eskimos. I spoke with people who loved wolves and people who hated them." This guy like just fully immerse himself in everything about wolves. Okay. "I remember sitting in the cabin in Alaska one evening, reading over the notes of all these encounters and recalling Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist, who wrote in conclusion to Primitive Mythology that men do not discover their gods, they create them. So do they also, I thought, looking at the notes before me, create their animals." Okay. So his main thesis and about what the problem is with wolves is, instead of learning about wolves, human beings have consistently formed imaginations about wolves and then treated that imagination as knowledge, or severely warped their study and their observation and their theorizing and their writing about wolves based on their imagination. And when I say imagination, I don't even mean like just scientific imagination. I mean like if you look through, okay, this is an astounding fact. The first scientific book written about wolves, published about wolves, like that actually tried to approach them from a strictly scientific, like biological perspective, was written in 1944, which to my mind is like mind-bogglingly late. Like, people were studying animals way before that, okay? But if you look through all the literature about wolves, it is just like superstition mixed with religious beliefs, mixed with symbolism, mixed with moralism and ethics, and like mysticism, all fused into one. And it's just people just projecting left and right onto wolves. So fallacy or bias number two is mistaking imagination for knowledge. Okay. Classic mistake. And I actually broke this down into a couple of other fallacies. Okay. So here's one fallacy. Okay. Oh, so first of all, this is a great line. So this is a general thing. "The latter point should be well taken. In the past, it was assumed that wolves were basely motivated and bloodthirsty. Then in an environmentally enlightened age, it was suddenly assumed that they were noble and wise. Okay, so shifted based on the age. So too, have we analyzed their hunting behavior in human terms, and none of it is worth more than the metaphor it's couched in. This habit indeed may eventually lead us even further from an understanding of the animal. For my own part, I mean to suggest that there is more to a wolf hunt than killing, and that wolves are wolves, not men. Okay, the mistake being, let me give a couple of analogies here, okay? So we've all heard of the alpha wolf, right? So you picture the alpha wolf, you probably picture like head of the pack, okay, right? So I don't know if you knew this. I didn't know this. He says, generally speaking, there are three separate social structures in the pack, a hierarchy of males, a hierarchy of females, and a more seasonally related cross-sexual social structure. There's typically an alpha or primary male that dominates the males and an alpha female that dominates the other females. I didn't know there was an alpha female, okay? But if you told me there's an alpha male and alpha female, I would immediately think, okay, it's basically like the king and the queen, you know? But no, it's not. This alpha pair is thought to be the breeding pair, but there are a good many cases in captivity and in the wild where a lower ranking male has bred with the alpha female, the alpha male expressing apparent disinterest. So then I'm like, okay, fine, but the alpha male is like the one who's like the leader of the entire pack, right? Wrong. Females may head packs and they always strongly influence pack activities. We often think of animals like the wolf who appear to have so many points in common with us in human social terms. With respect to females who have largely a subordinate standing in Western human societies, the analogy I think is poor. Female wolves may not only lead packs but outlast a succession of male alpha animals. It is females, moreover, who decide where to den and thus where the pack will have to hunt for 5 or 6 weeks. So they establish the kingdom, to use an anthropomorphism. In the north, where wolves are following migrating caribou, that's a typo there, a poor guess about where caribou are going to be can be disastrous, and the possibility of failure underlies the gravity of the female decision. Young males and therefore better hunt The male hunter image, the male hunter male leader image of the wolf pack is misleading, but unconsciously. I am sure it is perpetuated by males who dominate this field of study, right? Now, this is something we're beginning to be aware of how much male-dominated fields affect their perception of things. We know this especially in like psychology, where like before there were female psychologists, a lot of the theories were very, very like slanted in the direction of the way that males perceive things. But he's basically saying also that gender roles in wolves are basically projected by the male, the males who dominate the field. Okay. So that's like one example of anthropomorphization. Okay. Another one, for the same reason, paramilitary descriptions of wolf behavior where lieutenant wolves are dispatched to patrol the territory and parents will instill discipline in the pups creep in and strongly color our impressions of the animal, often without our knowing it. I'm certain that this is part of the reason people believe that male wolves always do the killing and why males' weights are often so exaggerated. So again, taking human jobs and human roles and then using that metaphor when it comes to studying wolves and then letting the metaphor influence how you interpret the behavior. Like once you define the wolf as a lieutenant, you start to think of it in lieutenant type ways. And then that blinds you to certain things and like distorts your thinking to other ways. So number three is unconsciously anthropomorphizing non-human phenomena. And by the way, again, as I go through these, in the back of your mind, start thinking about where this applies in Torah, okay? For example, I mean, just to say, what do you think is the non-human phenomenon that we anthropomorphize that tilts our knowledge?
God.
God. Yeah, exactly, right? So that's the obvious example, but then there are less obvious examples as well. So that's that let those thoughts like accumulate in the back of your mind. Okay. Wolf communication. So what do you think of when you think of how, if I ask you how do wolves communicate, what do you say being an ignorant human about wolves?
They bark.
Okay, howl. Interesting. So bark and howl. So it turns out, by the way, apparently wolves don't bark. Okay, it's a thing. And we'll get to that in a second. They bark very rarely, okay? But it's not a thing, but howling, right? But that's just part of it. So the social relationships of wolves are maintained through three systems of interpersonal and interpack communication: vocalization, postural signaling, and scent marking. And the whole first part of the book goes through like the insane like techniques that wolves use. Let's say like when they howl, okay? So the way that harmonics, I don't know in music if you know how harmonics work, but when you have one note, there are other notes that are layered on top of it that the human ear blends into one sound, but there are ways to separate the harmonics. Like, but the guy's into music. So like musicians can separate the harmonics. So wolves have ways of howling where you can have two or three wolves that howl in a way where they control the harmonics to make it sound like there are 10 or 20 wolves, you know, it's like stuff like that. And then there are different types of wolf signals in their howling. And then there's postural signaling of like certain ways that they stand, and then combos where standing and like vocalizing in certain ways means certain things. And then scent marking, I had no idea about. Like, you know about like marking territory is a thing animals do, but they have special glands like paw glands and like anal glands that that secrete like specific types of scents that they use for different purposes that can like spread communications throughout like the region, you know. So he goes through all this stuff, and then he says, our attempts to understand wolf language are crude and based not a little on the belief that the animal is simple-minded and therefore speaks a simple language. There are sounds we can't hear, and there are signals we don't see. As we begin to put vocalizations together with a more fluid and careful description of body movement, we are bound to discover considerably more about the wolf and the language of gesture. So, and if you read this chapter on wolf communication, you realize it's just so much more complicated. But if you walk in there, oh, wolf, dumb little animal, like bark, bark, you know, then you end up with like a simplistic idea. So number four, mistake number four is prejudging something as simple when it is actually complex. Okay, another classic mistake in many areas. Okay, now, speaking of barking, when people are trying to understand wolves, what do you think they make recourse to in their minds to draw data from?
Dogs.
Dogs, right? Bad move, okay? The reader may have been tempted by now to look at wolf behavior in terms of the sorts of things that domestic dogs do. It should be stressed here that this is not wise. Dogs suffer, I love the sentence, dogs suffer from a wide variety of emotional disorders, many of them brought on by the sort of selective breeding that destroys or radically alters their systems of communication. Tail docking, boxers, excessive facial hair, sheepdogs, ear cropping, Doberman pinschers, pendulous ears, bloodhounds, and uniform coloration, I don't know how to say that, all have forced dogs to seek other means of communication. Often the behavior that we see in them, scent marking, fire hydrant, for example, is an example of frustrated communication. So the thing is like, people look at dogs because like, yeah, it's basically like another type of wolf. And then they make inferences based on what dogs do to what wolves do, not realizing that wolves in a certain framework are messed up dogs. Like they diverge from, sorry, dogs are messed up wolves. Dogs diverge from the wolf population long ago, and through the large amount of interbreeding and then probably also like environmental factors and stuff, then their ways of signaling are messed up. They misfire. Like the example I was giving, I went over this with my Lumdeha students, and I think it's a good muscle that like, you know, a deer in the headlights will get hit by the car, right? It freezes and it'll get hit by the car. So you could point to that saying like, oh, that's a dumb deer, you know? But then when you think about it, well, why do deer freeze when they're threatened? Because the predators that they engaged with or that they encountered for thousands, tens of thousands, I don't know how long deers have been around, years, you know, couldn't see motion. So if they freeze, then it's a safety mechanism. But when you put them in a world with cars and roads, then it becomes a liability. So too with like domesticated dogs, especially with the crossbreeding, apparently like messes things up even more. So mistake number five is making unwarranted comparisons with what is familiar to us. Just because something is familiar to you doesn't mean that the thing you're studying is anything like it, you know? But the tendency to like just compare like to like and then to make inferences is you know, it's an easy way out, you know? Okay. All right. So now he starts to talk about biologists. And there are two mistakes here. It occurred to me early on in my association with wolves that I was distrustful of science. Now, again, this is a guy who the whole first part of the book is scientific, so it's not like, don't take him too seriously there. Not because it was unimaginative, though I think it is a charge that can be made against wildlife biology, but because it was narrow. I encountered what seemed to be, to me, eminently rational explanations for why wolves did some of the things they did, only to find wildlife biologists ignoring those ideas. True, some of the ideas were put forth by people who had only observed captive wolves. Their explanations were intriguing and rational, but it was admittedly taking quite a leap to extrapolate from the behavior of captive animals to include those in the wild. So this is like a classic mistake, okay? Well, first of all, two mistakes. Number one is being confined by the narrowness of the methods, which he's going to revisit later on. But his big criticism of biologists is they have specific things they're looking for and specific tools to measure them, and they disregard as not important or not real anything that doesn't conform to those tools, you know? And this is a mistake in like post-Newtonian, I think, science as well, when empiricism really got revved up to the point where like you have scientists who say, if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist, you know, or like an idiotic statement by Einstein. Okay. Like, and you know, he has very few of those, is he believed that there's no such thing, or at least according to Adler, there's no such thing as simultaneity. Why? Because you can't actually measure simultaneity. So there's no such thing. Well, that's not true. Philosophically, there's such a thing. Logically, there's such a thing. But like the fact that you can't measure it doesn't mean that it's not a thing, you know? So like that kind of mistake. The second mistake is hastily extrapolating from artificial to natural conditions. So these scientists, again, kind of like the dog mistake, is, you know, we have wolves in captivity and the scientists will observe those wolves and then make inferences based on those. Well, guess what? Wolves in captivity behave in a completely different way than wolves in the wild. So you're not going to necessarily gain any knowledge about, you might even get false ideas about wolves if you based on wolves in captivity. Okay.
So just about that quote, weren't they not extrapolating from artificial to natural conditions?
Yeah. In this statement, hold on a second. True, something I did for people who only observe capital. No. He's saying, so, okay, the biologists weren't. Yeah. I know there are people who were extrapolating based on captive wolves, and he is criticizing that for taking a leap from captive animals to include those in the wild. But you're right, he's saying the biologists are wary of that. Okay. So now he talks about biologists versus Eskimos. Now, just side point, because this is 2021. Apparently Eskimo is a derogatory term, okay? But they also tell me that Oriental is a derogatory term. And if you ask me and all the Orientals I know, it's not a derogatory term. And I asked the one Eskimo I know, and she says it's not a derogatory term. And he used the word Eskimo, so I'm going to use the word Eskimo throughout this whole thing, okay? I think part of the problem is that Eskimo is, not all people who live in those regions are Eskimos, but just be aware that if you meet someone who's an Eskimo, then they might think it's offensive to use the term, so make sure that it's not offensive. Okay, anyway, but clearly there was a body of evidence which seemed both rational and pertinent and which was being ignored. What people who lived in the Arctic among wolves who had observed them for years in the wild thought about them. Second, there was an even larger issue. What could be inferred about the behavior of wolves from the life ways of semi-nomadic human hunters who face virtually the same problems as the wolf in securing game and surviving in the Arctic? So after his chapter on biology, he turns to Eskimos because Eskimos have lived in virtually the same conditions that have been unchanged for thousands of years with wolves. And there's a rich experience-based cultural heritage of knowledge about wolves that they all have. And not only do they live with wolves, but they hunt in the same conditions as the wolves hunt, and they hunt the same animals like caribou. And that leads them to not only think about wolves, but to think like wolves. So mistake number 8 is discounting or undervaluing knowledge gained from experience. Okay. That the person who has a knowledge based on observations or theoretics, it's a different world than someone who's immersed in the area and based on experience. Okay. All right. This is, in my opinion, the scariest one. And this manifests itself in several ways. As wildlife biologist Robert Stevenson traveled around the tundra and the mountain country of the Nunamut, which is one of the tribes, it dawned on him that the wolves he was watching were not like the wolves described in the literature he had read. And the Nunamut were telling him things about wolves that no biologist at least, had ever written about. Not because they were odd or singular or mysterious things, but because they were things biologists were not interested in or never saw. So this, again, is the problem of... I call it being blinded by our own interests. Is if you are only interested in a certain thing, then you will not notice things that you deem not related to that thing, or things that you that will not advance you towards that thing. So he goes into more details about this, but I thought this was worthy to name on its own. So then he compares. Biologists are blinded by their own interests, and their biologists are not interested in what Eskimos have to offer. But now he talks about the attitude that Eskimos have towards biologists. Okay, the Nunamut Eskimos are genuinely pleased by the wolf biologists' attempts to understand the animal because they too are very interested in the wolf. but they find the biologist's method sometimes unfathomable and amusing. A Nunamut man was once shown a radio collar. The electronic principle involved was outlined. It was explained that a wolf wearing such a collar could be tracked wherever he went. He could never hide. The Eskimo said, "That's a very interesting piece of equipment. You should do that. You would learn a lot that way." He was deferring to a system of inquiry different from his own, but he did not think that biologists would learn much more about wolf movements than Eskimos already knew. So the difference between the Eskimos and the biologists is the Eskimos are open to other methods of inquiry, but the biologists are closed off to methods that differ from their own methods. Okay, and that's another bias. Okay, then he gives an insight into the Eskimo mentality about what they think about wolf knowledge. Nicholas Gubser, an anthropologist, wrote of these particular Eskimos, "The more reflective Nunamut do not search for a primordial cause, a complete explanation or order of the nature of ultimate destiny. For the Nunamut, there is no ultimate wolf reality," which is something we're going to get back to at the end, but this is what I want to focus on. "The animal is observed as a part of the universe. Some things are known, other things are hidden. Some of the wolf is known, some is not, but it is not a thing to be anxious over." So, and he's going to write about this later on, but he says basically that the Western man has this feeling where when they have a question, they feel like they need to find an answer. Or if they have partial knowledge, they feel that partial knowledge is like bad and that it needs to be rectified by having full knowledge and that there is a full knowledge. He's saying the Eskimos just don't have that way of thinking, is that they are comfortable sitting with questions, comfortable having partial knowledge, comfortable with the notion that wolves are mysterious. And therefore, they don't let their anxiety over partial explanations warp their thinking or force answers or propel them to decide that they have answered the full questions about wolves in a certain area. So they're open to sitting with this type of anxiety. Okay. Okay. So then he says, this is a related point. "The Nunamut have been watching wolves for as long as they can remember. Their knowledge is precise but open-ended. For a few weeks every summer, some of the Nunamut men watch wolves with spotting scopes from campsites in the Brooks Range, where they have an enormous field of view. One day, Justice McKeana, one of the older men, saw a wolf following a grizzly bear around all day at a distance of about 20 yards. Oh, but pause for a second. He has tons of these examples also of just like surprising wolf behavior. Like my favorite ones were he saw a lone wolf, no other wolves in sight for like miles, taking a frozen piece of caribou meat and just like throwing it up and playing catch with itself for like 40 minutes or something like that, you know, just to entertain itself. Or another group of wolves that just went and played a prank on ducks. Like they just went and like crept up on ducks and then just scared them and then ran away. Not because they wanted to eat the ducks, but like they could find no other reason why they wanted to do this and no advantage, you know. So he has a lot of like these things of like surprising wolf behavior. But anyway, so this guy saw a wolf following a grizzly bear around all day at a distance of about 20 yards. He took his eye from the spotting scope to say, "That's a new one. I haven't seen that before." Someone mentioned a family of wolves that had howled every day for 2 weeks during the denning season. Mekiana said he had never known wolves to do that in 40 years of watching them, but he added, "I wonder if wolves change their behavior over time, you know, different in some ways from 30 years ago." If he is correct, then the implications for wildlife biology are staggering. It means that social animals evolve, that what you learn today may not apply tomorrow, that in striving to create a generalized static animal, you have lost the real dynamic animal. The nature of Mekiana's stake in the right answer is such that he remains open to many more possibilities. And again, before we go into like Torah, just an example of this in science, in the sciences, you know, you have psychology, which is trying to study those aspects of the human being that are like unchanging. But then you have sociology and anthropology, which realize that like human beings have different conventions and different like values throughout different societies and that they changed. And if you try to like approach the human organism and say that they behave in exactly the same way in every single society, we recognize that that's ridiculous. Well, he's arguing that wolves are also social creatures and that maybe there's also social evolution in wolf societies as well, as evidenced by the fact that like these Eskimos that have lived with this have never seen or heard of certain behaviors, even though they've been watching them constantly every day, like for, you know, the whole, their whole existence. So the mistake here is treating a dynamic phenomenon as static, that there are static phenomena in the universe, but if it's dynamic, then don't treat it as static. Okay. Now this, I really was tempted to read to you this entire 3-page account, but I decided not to. He basically describes an in-depth expedition with a biologist and an Eskimo. And the biologist was like looking for certain things. And the Eskimo like noticed a wolf. And then through the scope, he said, oh, you notice like her hair is thinner around her like mammary glands. So I think that means that she probably gave birth recently. That means that there's a den somewhere close by. So let's look for the den. Oh, there's a twig over there. And then, okay, the den's got to be over here. And then he just found this den. And then they found like this wolf den, you know? So he goes through this whole thing in depth. Then he writes, as Stevenson's the name of the biologist, as Stevenson himself demonstrated, the chances were excellent that all this would have escaped. Oh, sorry. The Stevenson was the guy writing about this. Chances were excellent that all of this would have escaped the field biologist. I mean, he would have missed out. Yeah, he would not have seen the track, looked up, or guessed at the den. Edward T. Hall, the anthropologist, has called this difference of sensitivity the result of a difference in culturally patterned sensory screens. And studies by Judith Kleinfield have shown that Eskimos are very good at picking up visual detail better than most whites. So this is what I meant by scary, is that there are, and maybe you have this in certain areas of expertise that you have, but like, things that are sensory that you don't sense if you don't have the cultural disposition for it or the expertise for it. So examples, I mean, the saying that people have is Eskimos have 50 words for snow, you know? But the example he gives is he says Eskimos, I think it was Eskimos have 13 different categories of depth perception, okay? Because they live in a world where it's all snow and like there's snow blindness, there's like darkness, there, you know, so they perceive different things that than we do. We just have like one category, or let's say like a more common example, artists see more colors than we do, than we non-artists see them, because we don't have names for all the colors, but artists who are living in a world where colors are a thing see different colors than we do, you know, because they have names for them. So lacking awareness of our culturally patterned sensory screens is a bias because it could blind us to things. Okay, a few more. This one is, okay, another scary one. Another thing that sets the Nunamiut and the biologists apart in the field is subtle, but worth noting. When the Nunamiut hunter goes out, he leaves his personal problems behind as though they were a coat he had left on a hook. He slips instead into a state of concentrated, relentless attention to details. The depth of a track, the bend of grass along trails in a certain valley, the movement of ravens in the distance. It is the custom of most biologists, on the other hand, not only to bring their mental preoccupations into the field, but to talk about them while they are walking along. Eskimos rarely speak when they are on the move and are inattentive to questions, giving only brief answers. So Eskimos are walking around silent and open to all observations. Biologists are like chatting away and like talking about stuff. And like, and it kind of reminds me of like the difference between a Freudian psychoanalyst and like some other psychoanalyst. A Freudian psychoanalyst mostly listens, but can you imagine what a Freudian psychoanalyst thinks when they see another psychoanalyst listening to the patient, and the patient says something and the psychoanalyst goes like, oh, what you mean to say is blah, blah, blah. You know, like if you're interfering and you're like not opening yourself to like just listening and seeing and perceiving, you're like missing out on stuff and warping stuff. And I actually thought of an example of this. So I guess the method is not giving our full attention when engaging observation. Over the winter break, I watched a bunch of episodes of Planet Earth, the original Planet Earth. So there was this expedition where they went into the Gobi Desert to try to find these rare types of camels that I guess the Gobi Desert is so cold that it doesn't rain. It only like there's only snow that accumulates. So these camels have to like eat snow and then melt it for like their hydration. And apparently these camels, like no one sees them. The Gobi Desert is huge. Like apparently even finding the Gobi Desert, even though it like takes up a huge landmass, was difficult. I don't know what that means exactly. So they talk to this guy, this old Mongolian guy who tracks camels who's like in his 70s and like tracks camels. So like, how did he find the camels? So first of all, he was very wary about any little sound that they made could like scare the camels off, even like miles in the distance. So what would he do? You know how when you see the road and you see like the heat waves in the air, like rippling. So he would just look in the distance and like sense like, I think I see a ripple over there. It was sensing like the 40 miles away, like the body heat of the camels causing a slight atmospheric disturbance. And like, he's just open to these things. And like the Planet Earth guys just had no clue, like, you know, what to look for. And like, even if they knew what to look for, they couldn't see it. Okay. Two more. So everything up in here has been drawn from the first two sections of the book. He has a lot in the literature section, but I chose not to incorporate it into this. The one, though, that I did think was relevant is the church, okay? So he's talking about why wolves were not studied scientifically for so long. Okay. And he has a lot of stuff about how almost all cultures regarded the wolf as evil in some way. Okay. There were a few that had wolves that were beneficent, you know, but most of them were like, wolves are the embodiment of evil, greed, power, rape, like devils, demons, all this other stuff. So he says, and yet when Laman came to ask, in effect, what is this animal alone and how does he get on in the universe? Meaning he just wanted to know, what is the wolf as a creature? The church responded less than compassionately. When Laman said, let us consider the wolf as a biological entity, quite apart from the devil and pagan worship and evil and the symbolism of man's bestial nature, the church, the seat of appeal for such inquiries in the Middle Ages, replied, no, it would not be appropriate even to consider such a thing. So he actually goes through and really shows how, like, even when certain aspects of science were allowed to be studied by the church just shut the door on wolves, because wolves were assumed to be like in league with the devil, you know? I hesitate to single out the church as the lone culprit to bear responsibility for such ignorance. Clearly this was not so, because there were lots of other forces, but it is inescapable that the church, because it largely controlled both the publication of books and the institutions of learning, profoundly affected the progress of natural history by subjecting it to theological constraint, by making it conform to preconceived ideas. What the church supported survived, what it regarded as an error and a secular interest in animals smacked of paganism did not. So I wasn't sure what to call this, because the church is not the only one. His chapter about hunters also shows how like all of the, or many of the wildlife regulatory bodies that could have become institutes of knowledge of wolves became wolf hunters, you know, and wolf exterminators. So I call this granting power to institutionalized forces that inhibit our knowledge. Okay. Then we get down to what the author Lopez thinks is the main error. And I didn't number this one. I'm just going to list it, because according to him, all of these stem from this one thing. Okay. And this is the longest excerpt. It can't be emphasized too strongly that the wolf simply goes about his business and men select. Oh, and by the way, and you'll see some of the 15 in what I read here. And men select only those few things that the wolf does that interest them to pay attention to. The biologist counts placental scars on the uterus of the dead female, something that would never occur to an Eskimo to do. An Eskimo looking for caribou is attentive to the direction of movement of wolves in various places over a period of weeks, something the biologist might regard as only anecdotal information in his reports. The mistake that is made here, with consistency it seems, only by educated Western people, is to think that there is an ultimate wolf to be divined, one that can only be unearthed with microscope and radio collar. Some wolf biologists are possessed by the idea that of binding the wolf up in statistically significant data. They want no question about the wolf not to have an answer. So I'm calling this unwarranted reductionism, of saying there is this one wolf and there's one method, and that's what we have to get to know wolves. So now he summarizes, and this is at the beginning of the fourth section of the book. Up to this point, I have been considering wolves from three fairly distinct viewpoints: as objects of scientific inquiry, as objects of interest to people bound up in the natural world with them, that's the Eskimos, and as objects of hatred for livestock raisers, that's the hunters. But the points of view are not quite so distinct, and the intimation that the wolf can be objectified is one that must ultimately break down even for science. We create wolves. Again, that's his thesis of the imagination. The methodology of science creates a wolf just as surely as does the metaphysical vision of a Native American or the enmity of a cattle baron of the 19th century. It is only by convention that the first is considered enlightened observation, the second fanciful anthropomorphism, and the third agricultural necessity. Each of these visions flows historically from man's never-ending struggle to come to grips with the nature of the universe. That struggle has produced, at least at different times in history, different places for the wolf to fit. And at the same moment in history, different ideas of the wolf's place in the universe have existed side by side, even in the same culture. So in the wolf, we have not so much as an animal that we have always known as one that we have consistently imagined. To the human imagination, the wolf has proved at various times the appropriate symbol for greed or savagery, the exactly proper guise for the devil, or fitting as a patron of warrior clans. How do people arrive at all these notions? The wish, of course, is to uncover some underlying theme that synthesizes all perceptions of the wolf, all allusions to him, in one grand animal. I will suggest some themes below, some ways to organize the visions so that when a human being suddenly confronts a wolf, there can be both a sense of the richness of ideas associated with the animal and a sense that an orderly mind has been at work. But I am not hopeful that a feeling of integration will be forthcoming. And even if it is, I don't think it should be trusted. Now, here's the main point. It seems important to be kept slightly off balance through all this. Otherwise, the temptation is to think that although what we are examining may be complex, it is in the end reducible. I cannot, in light of his effect on man, conceive of the wolf as reducible. So he's saying the main mistake is that our thinking is dominated by unwarranted reductionism. And that really is the source of all these errors of reducing wolves to humans, reducing wolves to this tool, reducing wolves to our experience, you know, all of that. Okay, so that's the end of my wolf rant. Okay. But now let's go to Torah. Okay. So the thing that triggered these thoughts that kept coming to my mind in all of this wolf stuff was the second paragraph of the Ralbag's Hakdama to Torah, okay, which our Chumash methodology Shir did early in the year. So the first paragraph should be well known to many of my students, which is the definition of Torah as the regimen that brings those who practice it properly to true success, which is knowledge of God to the extent possible. And then immediately after that, he states the following, okay. It is vital not to lose sight of the fact that it is impossible for us to completely apprehend the wisdom and beneficence which is manifest in the Torah's existence. In other words, it is impossible to completely understand the chachma of Torah and the goodness of Torah. Okay? Rather, we have very little knowledge of this, and we are exceedingly ignorant, just as we have very little knowledge of the wisdom and beneficence which is manifest in the nature of all existing things. We apprehend very little of the wisdom of their creation, as is evident to anyone who has intensively studied the natural sciences and who recognizes the gap between our theoretical models of the laws of the universe and their reality. It therefore follows from the fact that the Torah is divine, namely that it is from Hashem, as is known to all people today, that its nature will also be incompletely understood, even though it is the absolute truth. So in English, in Ralbagian, non-Ralbagian English, what he's saying is like this. The Torah is from God. And nature is from God. Now, anyone who studies nature knows how little we know about nature. And again, you have all of my favorite quotes that I've read many times of, like, you know, Newton saying that I'm like a little boy picking up a beautiful seashell here and there while the whole ocean of truth lies undiscovered before me. You know, the true scientists realize how little we know about the universe. And they're aware that what are we doing is that there is the reality of the universe. And then there's our theoretical models that we make, you know, our theories, and we're just trying to get closer and closer and closer to the reality, but we're very far away and we're just scratching the surface. So what the Ralbag is saying is just like that's true of the universe because it's created by God, so too the Torah is created by God, and therefore it too is impossible to completely understand. And therefore, what are we doing is in the same way as in science, we are, with nature, I mean, we're coming up with theories, scientific theories that are approximating and bridging the gap between the reality of the universe and our minds. So too with Torah, there's the reality of Torah, which arguably only God and Moshe Rabbeinu knew. Okay. And then there's our incomplete theoretical models of Torah that we're trying to get as close as we can to understanding Torah, but it's incomplete. Okay. And this was a revolutionary idea for me because I think that the natural way we think of things is that there is such a thing as a correct understanding of Torah. And let's say, for example, take, like, you know, the hardcore Maimonidean will say, yeah, like the Rambam's Mishnah Torah is like the system that is like, that's what Torah really is. And like the Kabbalist will say, like, no, this mystical version of Torah, that's what Torah really is. Okay. And the Ralbag saying, and the Ralbag has his system of Torah, but he's saying, no, that's just one approach to Torah that's trying to bridge the gap. Okay, so when I thought about that, I realized, oh man, we're making all of these mistakes in so many areas of Torah. Okay, so just to give you a smattering, and I'm not going to try to list all of them, but here's a couple ones that occurred to me for each one. Okay, so number one, overestimating our knowledge or underestimating our ignorance. That we make, I don't need examples of that, that we do all the time. Okay, two, mistaking imagination for knowledge. So this, I think, is what all of us fall prey to in new areas of Torah, is that, like, or, you know, to varying degrees, especially when emotions are involved, is we immediately start forming theories that are not based on the facts, but are just based on wishes or on prejudices or on, like, feelings or on how we want things to be. And then we let that guide our investigation. And again, you'll either think that what I'm saying is obvious or you'll say, I don't do that. But, like, you know, after watching high schoolers, especially who are being exposed to many areas for the first time, it is just evident how much wishful thinking or fearful thinking guides investigations of like not thinking about certain areas because you don't want to face them, or thinking about things, thinking that things are a certain way because that's how you want them to be. You know, people do this all the time about God, about mitzvos, about like hashgacha, you know, okay, lots of examples of that. Number three, unconsciously anthropomorphizing non-human phenomena. So we definitely talked about that in relation to God himself. I mean, again, people anthropomorphize wolves that you can see with your eyes. So certainly a being who you can't see, people anthropomorphize. But take the examples, let's say like the gender roles, okay? You know, so much of the literature in the Masorah and in the Rishonim is, to be frank, based on you know, and this is going to sound like all progressive, but I'm not saying this in a progressive way. So much of it is based on like men's perceptions of women, you know, and like it is very, very clear from a lot of the statements that have been made by the more, you know, like we talked about this in one of my Chumash methodology shiurim, that like, you know, Rambam held that women were not as intelligent. The average woman is not as intelligent as men. Okay. Now that there are indications from the Rambam that he held that that was, by nurture, not nature. Okay. Meaning that women were not provided with an education, et cetera. Rabag seems to have held that women were inherently inferior intellectually and were designed that way. Okay. And another Rishon, who I'm not even going to tell you, because number one, you won't know who he is. Number two, I don't want to prejudice you, actually holds that women don't have a tzelem Elohim. Okay. Which I don't know how he gets that from the Torah, because it says Zahar Unakeva Bara Osam, you know, but like, what, you know? So, but the point is that like, you know, I think a lot of gender roles, a lot of racial roles, a lot of like, you know, the way we relate to ourselves in the world are based on certain human categories that originated in certain eras and then are projected onto the objective Torah as a system. You know, here's another crazy example is there's an article that appears in Chakira, Journal of Jewish Thought, about male practices of grooming. Okay. And like, you know, like, you know, you have the issur of beget ish and beget isha. And like, basically the basic rule is like a man is not allowed to do something that's a woman's cosmetic procedure. So this author goes and he details like all of the differences in the Gaonic and Arabic lands and like in Ashkenazic lands and like stuff that the Ashkenazic Jew says, that's a girly feminine practice. Like the men in like the Arab lands are like, what do you mean? This is what real men do, you know? And it was in an area that was like very halakhic, but like, you just see how it's just based on cultural perceptions of things. Cause each of them who were writing thought that this was the objective, like reality, not just, they weren't saying it as like, this is what people in our lands do. They're saying like, no, this is the objective thing, you know? So there are many examples of this. Another example, again, like, okay, there's so many examples of this. You know, we talk about God as Melech, you know, but we here live in a society that is a democracy, you know, or a, you know, democratic republic. So whenever we think of Malchus stuff, we just project our own ideas of leaders and of societies based on our own democratic experience onto the institutions of Torah and onto like, you know, God being Melech and all this other stuff, you know? So, okay, fine. Lots of examples of that. Four, I don't think I need to come up with examples of this, prejudging something as simple as when it's actually complex. You know, I'm just going to skip around. Hold on. Okay. Six, being confined by the narrowness of our methods. So if you've ever, okay, some people might disagree with this. If you've ever looked at briskers on Torah, now, I'm not talking about Rav Soloveitchik. I'm talking about like briskers on Torah. I don't know if anyone's ever seen this. Like they literally take the brisker derech of like Chafetz Gavra and Chol Hashem and just like give Divrei Torah about it. Like about like, you know, on the narrative portions of Torah, you know? And like, I remember when I first saw that, it just struck me as this very artificial imposition of something that is a very good halakhic method, but imposing on a non-halakhic area. And what, you know, there are many Darkei Halimud within Torah. And I think something that all possessors of Darkei Halimud are guilty of is thinking that their derech is the ultimate derech and like just, you know, not seeing or confining themselves to that derech, you know? And like I remember, I mean, I've heard this from people in, you know, who are Tamid HaChachamim, like, you know, in our yeshiva, we learn according to the brisker derech. And like, I've heard people say we shouldn't learn Nach because we don't have a methodology like that about Nach. So we shouldn't learn it. And I'm like, what do you mean? Maybe there are other ways someone learned. Like, who's to say that having something that looks exactly like Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's Brisker Derech is like the only way to learn Tanakh? Like, maybe there's other methods, you know? Or, you know, so again, being confined by your own methods. Hastily extrapolating from artificial and natural conditions and discounting or undervaluing knowledge gained from experience. So I haven't done this, but I imagine that if you learn the halakhos of shechita just from a gemara versus if you learn the halakhos of shechita from someone who's actually a shochet and your hands are like covered in blood and you have like animals there, it's a very different knowledge experience, you know? And I feel like there is a lot of what we learn is purely intellectual, whether it's halakha, whether it's Tanakh, whether it's like other stuff. And if we immersed ourselves in the experiences that data is drawn from, we would relate to the knowledge in different ways. And like my own experience from this was the greatest when I went to graduate school, because for the first half of my grad school, I was not yet a high school teacher. And then in the second half I was, and it was night and day reading about teaching practices before I was in the classroom and then reading about teaching classes, practices when I was in the classroom. And like parents describe this all the time, like reading parenting books and then actually having a kid and needing to parent them. So it's like, I wonder how much we're missing out on in Torah, because our knowledge is completely in either artificial conditions or purely intellectual conditions and not actually like immersing ourselves in the, like the realia, as like fancy people say, of like the, of the phenomena that the halachos and narratives pertain to.
An example of that, like a big example that just occurred to me is like Korbanos and like the Beis Hamikdash.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I was going to bring that up. That's a good point. We have zero experience with anything like that nowadays. So like, how can we hope to get a real sense of like what Chazal we're talking about? And not even that, take number eight again, discounting or undervaluing knowledge gained from experience. How much of Taryag are we actually keeping? A fraction, right? I forgot, we kind of like estimated this when we were doing Rama Bakush here, but let's say like a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, an eighth, a tenth, you know, I don't know how much of Taryag we're keeping. When Chazal were writing about, and not even Chazal, because like they didn't even all have the basic majors. Let's say when someone in the era of like the Nevi'im was, let's say it's time, when Snaim were writing about Halacha, they were living in a system of keeping more of Taryag than we are. And living that life will lead you to relate to the knowledge in different ways. Or in Pirkei Avos, when you know, Hillel Haya Omer, and he lived according to that ethical principle, and we are studying it as someone who is from outside of it, we're relating to the knowledge in different ways. So, like, I think we're really missing out a lot. 12 is a biggie, treating a dynamic phenomena as static. So, again, we like to believe that there is, you know, the Torah is eternal, okay? And we like to believe that it's static. But eternal and static are different. You know, with every year that goes by, and I plan on giving a share about this later on, I have come to realize that what makes the Torah eternal is that it's dynamic by design, that the Torah is designed to take man through different evolutions of thinking, different evolutions of morality, you know, serving different purposes in different eras, and that's what allows the Torah to be relevant in every generation. If it were static, it would cease to be relevant, would cease to be relevant along with all the other ancient societies. And not only is it dynamic in like the function, but in the very form of the Torah is dynamic. Like, again, look, if Moshe Rabbeinu went to a shul today, he would have absolutely no idea what's going on. Why? Because tefillah now is completely different than what tefillah was in Moshe Rabbeinu's time. There were no shuls. I mean, there's no minyan in Moshe's time. There was no set text of tefillah. There was no three times a day. There's no Shabbos Mechamarev. There's no connection to Korban. You know, there was no word. It was a completely different thing, you know? Or take Shabbos, you know, like Shabbos, when the Torah was given, just 39 Malachos, Kum, Zachor, and, you know, like Kiddush and like, and Shavuos, you know, versus our whole Shabbos of like Shalosh Sudos and all the Gedarim Derabbanan and Oneg and Kavod and all those halachos and Shabbos clothing. And it's a completely different experience, you know? And like the Sanhedrin and the Nevi'im had this role of helping the Torah adjust the eternal aspects of the Torah, adjust the times that we were in. But then now that we don't have Nevi'im, we don't have the Sanhedrin, it's kind of frozen, you know? But like, you know, that's another thing. How many, how much of our misunderstanding of Torah now is based on the fact that we're looking at a, like, I use this analogy, like, you know, kids who think that Torah is not relevant, or not kids, just people who think Torah is not relevant. You know, imagine a dystopian future, okay, where you're walking along in the field with an elder, okay, and the elder finds this piece of scrap metal, and he says, oh, like, I didn't know we would encounter one of these. And you're like, what is that? And he'd be like, oh, this is like part of the propeller. And you're like, what's a propeller? And he's like, oh, it was something in a wing of a plane. And there were these things called jets that would, like, let people fly from continent to continent. And like you're looking at him like, what are you talking about? It's just like a sheet of metal, you know? I feel like that's how our view of Torah is like, we have this partial view of something that we can't relate to, that was really part of a larger entity, that was a dynamic living force in the world that we only see the small part of, you know? Not giving our full attention to observation, number 14, you know, like, again, we're just looking for certain things and just closing ourselves off to just like, we don't have enough. Okay. This goes hand in hand. Okay. Hand in hand with number 10, 11, allowing our anxiety over partial explanations to warp our thinking. I know one thing that Rav Pesach says a lot to the Shalhevet students. I don't remember from my days in Yeshiva, is appreciate the question. I guess that was one of his taglines. And that's important. Okay. But part of appreciating the question is not just saying, okay, I'm going to think about the question a bit before I go on. It's being able to sit without an answer for a half an hour, an hour, a day, a week, a month, a year, a decade, your life. You know, there might be answers that you just don't get for like 10 years. There might be answers that we cannot answer right now. Like oftentimes in Aram and Bekiyos Kavura, I bemoan the fact that there's no one in our generation who has stepped forward to do with modern physics what the Rambam did with Aristotelian physics, meaning who understands physics and philosophy and the metaphysics of Torah and has come up with a synthesized presentation of what a Torah true metaphysics is. We might not live to see that. That might happen like a generation from now or 100 years from now, you know? And we just have to sit here like knowing like, okay, fine, we're lacking here, you know? And similarly with like being comfortable just observing things, you know? Like sometimes when you're doing Bekius, you just have to like sometimes you do Bekius with questions and answers and investigation. Sometimes you have to do Bekius and just like let the text wash over you. Like when we do an Artillim thing, sometimes you just gotta like read the Tillim, let it hit you and just see what you notice. And if you walk in there with like Adler's four questions, you know, then you will not open yourself to noticing things. Or if you're like, I got to focus on all the questions here, or like fit it into the Mishle method of methodology, like, you know, it can limit you. Anyway, so these are a bunch of things. I mean, and I could go on, but like this is what I mean by like an epistemological upheaval of just seeing all of these things. I guess what I've never had in my life, a full walkthrough of a subject from so many different angles by someone who is so aware of how limited his knowledge is, that it shocked me into realizing how much we must be doing this with Torah. And all of these points are points that I think we've known before, but something about the experience just shocked me. And I find myself like at a loss. And I want to finish this up, okay, because as I was going to go into the Sefer HaChinuch. If you look at the Sefer HaChinuch on Mikdash, he talks like this wolf guy, okay, about how afraid he is of like approaching Mikdash to give theories about what it's about, and how Shivim Panim LaTorah, and how like any little piece that we get is good, whether he eats a little bit or much. It's exactly like the wolf guy, but it's about Mikdash, and it's depicting like this humility and this like being content with partial knowledge that I think we could use a lot more of when we approach other areas. But let's end off with what the author of Wolves and Men says are some solutions, okay? So I have three excerpts that we'll end with. From here on, I will try to create a feeling for wolves that we may once have had as a people ourselves, but have long since lost. One in which we do not know all the answers, but are not anxious. An appreciation of wolves, it seems to me, lies in the wider awareness that comes when answers to some questions are for the moment simply suspended. So that's what I just talked about a little bit, is being willing to sit with questions and not clamor for answers or force answers or or be upset that you don't have answers, and being willing to know that you might not have answers ever for certain questions in your life, or it might take a very, very long time. So that's one thing. Then he says, but in the 20th century, whether out of guilt or because we have reached such a level of civilization to allow us the thought, we are looking for a new wolf. We seem eager to be corrected, to know how wrong our ideas about wolves have been, how complex the creature really is, how ultimately unfathomable. So this is another thing I think we could do, is having an attitude of being eager to be corrected and eager to find flaws in your thinking. Like, I think the first step has to be eagerness for a methodology, because methodologies are where you have to start. Otherwise, you're just like an ignoramus, you know? But then the pendulum has to swing the other way of eager to see holes or gaps in your methodology, or eager to see limitations in your methodology. And along with that comes eagerness to get back to that state of wonder. Like, again, Bruce, oh, you don't know how difficult it was for me to not bring Bruce Lee into this, by the way. Like, every single one of these statements, there are Bruce Lee quotes, but I knew if I opened it up to Bruce Lee, then the whole thing would just become about Bruce Lee. But like I think the Chinese phrase is wuxin, which is beginner's mind. I forgot if that's that or something else, but like being able to like get to that original sense of like wonder and awe and exploration that gets covered over by the expert who thinks that he knows. So that's another thing we can do. I do not think it possible to define completely the sorts of animals men require in order to live. They are always changing and are different for different peoples. Nor do I think it possible that science can by itself produce the animal entire. The range of the human mind, the scale and depth of the metaphors of the mind is capable of manufacturing as it grapples with the universe stand in stunning contrast to the belief that there's only one reality, which is man's, or worse, that only one culture among many on earth possesses the truth. And again, I'm guilty of this as anyone, whether it's because I'm a Brisker, whether it's because I'm a Maimonidean, whether it's because I'm from YBT, whether it's because I'm a rationalist, whether it's because I'm a Western thinker, whether it's because I like Bruce Lee, you know, whether it's because I like logic, you know, it's just closing myself off to other ways of thinking that might have validity. And I'm going to give you a random, a wild example. Okay. And it's such a wild example that I can't even articulate it. Okay. But it was a moment I had. One of my friends, who is another educator, is very into Breslov Hasidus. Okay. Or he admires Rav Nachman of Breslov and his teachings. Okay. Now, I don't know anything about Hasidus, but the one branch of Hasidus that I feel like I would be most against is Breslov, because of its anti-knowledge stance and anti-philosophy stance. But I saw one comment from this educator about what Rav Nachman of Breslov was trying to do. And I don't even remember what it was, but I'm going to try to like describe it, is that it was not trying to answer questions, but trying to come up with an approach to cope in an existential way with the lack of answers. Okay. And what I realized was, oh, maybe what I thought was an anti-knowledge stance was based on the assumption that he was trying to get knowledge. And therefore, when he was rejecting philosophy, he was saying philosophy can't give you knowledge. But maybe the Breslov and Hasidim are not even trying to get knowledge. Maybe they're grappling with a different problem, and I'm just not aware of the problem because of the narrowness of my methods. And like just realizing like that you know, that this is what I don't think this is what Shivan Panim LaTorah means when Chazal use it, but I think that this is what people mean when they say Shivan Panim LaTorah, is just so many different methodologies and angles and ways that are that just like you have the biologist view of the wolf and the Eskimos and like the hunters and the, you know, it's just different angles of the phenomenon. So anyway, to allow mystery, which is to say there could be more, there could be things we don't understand, is not to damn knowledge. Again, that's another thing, is like I feel like there's a Western tendency to, if you don't have an answer, that's like a failure. No. It's not to damn knowledge. It's to take a wider view. It is to permit yourself an extraordinary freedom. Someone else does not have to be wrong in order that you may be right. In the Western world, in the biological sciences, we have an extraordinary tool for the discovery of knowledge about animals, together with a system for its classification. And through the existence of journals and libraries, we have a system for its dissemination. But if we are going to learn more about animals, real knowledge, not more facts, we are going to have to get out into the woods. And we have to do that with Torah, whatever you say that means, getting out into the woods of Torah. We are going to have to pay more attention to free ranging as opposed to penned animals, which will require an unfamiliar patience. And we are going to have to find ways in which we single startling incident in animal behavior, now discarded in the winnowing process of science's data assembly, can be preserved, can somehow be incorporated. And we are going to have to find a way, not necessarily to esteem, but at least not to despise intuition in the scientific process. For it is, as Kepler and Darwin and Einstein have said, the key. The English philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, writing about human inquiry into the nature of the universe, said that in simply discussing the issues, the merest hint of dogmatic certainty is an exhibition of folly. This tolerance for mystery invigorates the imagination, and it is the imagination that gives shape to the universe. So embracing intuition with a healthy dose of mystery and a healthy distrust of dogmatism. And then the final part is the appreciation of the separate realities enjoyed by other organisms is not only no threat to our own reality, but the root of a fundamental joy. I learned from River, that was one of the Eskimos, that I was a human being and that he was a wolf. Oh, sorry. I got mixed up with the names. River is the name of his wolf. The name of his wolf that he raised, not one of the Eskimos. I learned from River that I was a human being and that he was a wolf and that we were different. I valued him as a creature, but he did not have to be what I imagined he was. It is with this freedom from dogma, I think, that the meaning of the words, the celebration of life, becomes clear. So that is...
Dogma.
Yeah, dogma. Yeah, I had the same thought. So that's me trying to present my wolf epiphany and upheaval. And again, I have no idea. I hope you got something from this. It's like seeing a movie and like trying to tell someone about it. Like you have to like have read the book to just be overwhelmed by the sheer amount of data and like examples. But at the very least, maybe listing the fallacies is useful because maybe you'll be aware of it. And then I just think like reiterating this idea about how we can't know Torah. We can only have theoretical models and bridge the gap between the real Torah as it exists in Moshe Rabbeinu's mind or in God's design and like our knowledge of it. And like realizing that our knowledge of Torah is not absolute and is just approximate, I think is like the healthiest antidote to all the fallacies that he's saying. So that's what I got to say about that. I'm not going to end this year. I'm ending it officially, but if you want to discuss, we can discuss. It's just that Rabbi Zimmer has a shear in 3 minutes. So yeah.
I had a question.
Sure.
It's kind of a little particular, but back in sure. your slides, I remember number 14 was like, not being too distracted while during observation.
Yeah. Right.
And I was wondering if you could like, think of an example in Torah
yeah.
where that would apply. Because I can totally example. See like, yeah. a hunter or, stalking and like being, sort of selfless while he's observing, but I don't know how you would do okay. that when you're learning.
Yeah. So I have two answers, one in the realm of Torah learning and the other in the realm of Torah practice. Okay. The example in the realm of Torah learning is a story that Rabbi Moskowitz tells a lot. So he said, Rabbi Moskowitz says, we, meaning Rabbi Moskowitz and the YBT guys and Rabbi Chait, were sitting around learning. I think he tells the stories on Sukkot, and we're doing this really hard sugya, and like no one could come up with a svara. And then suddenly, like Rabbi Chait comes up with a beautiful svara, and all the guys were like impressed. And I, Rabbi Moskowitz, being interested in methodology, went to Rabbi Chait and said, "How was it that you came up with the answer and no one else did?" Okay, and Rabbi Chait said, "Because everyone else was trying to think of an answer and I was just thinking about the question." Okay. And what I mean by that is that, and let me pair that with something else. Hold on just one second. Great mystery story. This is one of my favorite things in Einstein's book on the evolution of physics, right? So he says, in imagination, there exists the perfect mystery story. Such a story presents all the essential clues and compels us to form our own theory of the case. If we follow the plot carefully, we arrive at the complete solution for ourselves just before the author's disclosure at the end of the book. The solution itself, contrary to those of inferior mysteries, does not disappoint us. Moreover, it appears at the very moment we expect it. Can we liken the reader of such a book to the scientists who, throughout successive generations, continue to seek solutions of the mysteries in the book of nature? The comparison is false and will have to be abandoned later, but it has a modicum of justification, which may be extended and modified to make it more appropriate to the endeavor of science to solve the mystery of the universe. The great mystery story is still unsolved. We cannot even be sure it has a final solution. The reading has already given us much. Okay, fine. You know, I'll read it anyway. The part I wanted to get to is at the end. It has taught us the rudiments of language of nature. It has enabled us to understand many of the clues and has been a source of joy and excitement in the oftentimes painful advance of a science. But we realize that in spite of all the volumes read and understood, we are still far from a complete solution. This is very in line with what the wolf guy was saying. If indeed such a thing exists at all. At every stage, we try to find an explanation consistent with the clues already discovered. Tentatively accepted theories have explained many of the facts, but no general solution compatible with all known clues has yet been evolved. Very often, a seemingly perfect theory has proven inadequate in light of further reading. New facts appear, contradicting the theory or unexplained by it. The more we read, the more fully do we appreciate the perfect construction of the book, even though a complete solution seems to recede as we advance. Okay, now here's the part I wanted to get to. In every detective novel since the admirable stories of Conan Doyle, there comes a time where the investigator has collected all the facts he needs for at least some phase of his problem. These facts often seem quite strange, incoherent, and wholly unrelated. The great detective, however, realizes that no further investigation is needed at the moment and that only pure thinking will lead to a correlation of the facts collected. So he plays his violin or lounges in his armchair enjoying a pipe when suddenly, by Jove, he has it. Not only does he have an explanation of the clues for the clues at hand, but he knows that certain other events must have happened. Since he now knows exactly where to look, he may go out if he likes to collect further confirmation for his theory. So there's one level you're familiar with. You're familiar with this in the realm of learning. And that's what Rabbi Moskowitz was highlighting in the story, that there are people who will be at the thinking phase and will be looking for an answer. And then there will be people who let the facts and the questions just roll around in their mind. And just letting yourself be open to the intuitive gusts of wind that come by, intuitive breezes or undercurrents, and ride those. And if you're just clamoring for an answer, you're going to miss out on those. So that's like level one. Level two is, he said, there's a time when you've gathered all the facts and no further investigation is needed, and then you just think. Now, that might be true, but you also have to be aware that even if you're going to engage in thinking, you should also be open to new facts and on the lookout for new facts. Now, that's in a sugya, it's easier to know that you have all the facts. But let's say it's an area of, like, in hashkafa, like mitzvos or like God's oneness or something, you know, I think it's very easy to feel like you have all the facts. But continuing to be open to new facts and allowing yourself to be on the lookout for things or new angles, like, it's a frame of mind which you need to consciously strive for. Otherwise, you'll just, like, feel like you have all the facts already, you know? And then similarly with svaras, like, there's the type of person who, I mean, again, it drives a lot of people crazy, who will be in a Rabbi Chait's Gemara Shir on Hanukkah, on Sukkah, on Matzah, something that is done from year to year. And Rabbi Chait will have the question, and it'll be time for a svara. And then someone will say, Rebbe, didn't you give a svara on this in 1977? And like, he'll say the svara, and Rebbe will be like, sometimes politely, sometimes like impatiently, like, I don't want to hear what I said in 1977. Because we're trying to be open to like new angles and stuff like that. So that's what I'd say in the realm of learning. It's a combination of being open to like mulling over the facts, being open to new facts, and being open to new svaras and new ways of thinking about things. That's like the equivalent there. Okay. And then in keeping mitzvahs, here's an example: tzedakah. Okay. So you can have the biologist of tzedakah who reads his manual, how to do tzedakah, and then goes and like executes the procedure. And then you have the person who's really doing the mitzvah of tzedakah, who goes and like actually sits with the poor person and like hears, listens to them, like smells like what it is like to be a human being that can't take a bath, like sees the confusion in their eyes and like the mental illness or the sadness or the, like, you know, feels the cold, as, you know, there are ways to involve yourself in mitzvos that is not just a robotic execution of the thing, but an immersion in the full experience of the mitzvah that will actually get you closer to what the tam ha-mitzvah is. So that's why I'm using tzedakah as an example of this, because like, that is the goal of tzedakah, is to like, fully empathize with this other human being as a fellow Melukim who's in need, and to see like where you could be in that state. And I feel like we withhold ourselves from having that experience in many, many mitzvos, you know, like, look, I don't want to make assumptions about you. I know what I'm going to do for Matanos Levionim. I'm just going to give money to Leslie Unger and he's going to take it to Yad Yeshaya, and I'm just not going to have any experience interacting with Aniyim, you know? And like, am I being Yotzei the mitzvah? Yeah. Am I getting out of the mitzvah what you know Chazal intended when they established it? Am I fully like opening myself up to the mitzvah experience and like really like being b'halakta b'drachav? No, I'm not, you know? And that's, is that good? No, it's bad, you know? So I think if we think through many, many mitzvos, then you'll find ways to like, you know, each unique to its own mitzvah to like, to, you know, to do this.
I really like that.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Wow.
Okay.
that was on the whole thing. That was...
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Someone asked me, one of my students asked me this morning from Lundell, what am I going to do now? Like, how do I anticipate this changing things, you know? And what I'd like to say is that I'd like to say that I will be more aware of these fallacies. And I think you're going to have to pull a Hilchos Deos thing of like, it's not going to be enough to just have it in mind. I think you're going to have to go to extremes in order to get to the middle path. And I don't know what that looks like. But I think there's gonna, you know, I think it's gonna be too easy to fall back into the default, you know. But definitely just being aware of my own prejudices is a step forward. And so I hope that it sticks. And I think the reductionist thing is big, like looking for one idea of something and that and thinking it's an idea that could be attained. And like in the same way of thinking where there's one wolf, there's an ultimate wolf reality that we're trying to understand. Thinking, yeah, there's one idea of what a mitzvah is. There's one idea of what Torah is. There's one idea of what hashgacha is. There's one, you know, I think like we do that a lot, you know, and we do that because we are Western Maimonidean Aristotelians. Like, you know, we look for definite answers that have clarity that fit into systems, you know, and like it's, you know, and that is a valid perspective. Like if I gave this year to, a mystic, I'd say like you could learn a lot from the Rambam, you know, but like you know, but yeah, it's yeah. All right. So that's
that. Yeah. I actually have a resolution that I decided on like over the course of this year.
Yeah.
Maybe off recording now.
Mm. All right, let me stop recording. One thing that I have been trying to do that has led me to this is now that I've carved out more space to read nonfiction during the week. I mean, the fact that like, I would not have read this book, this is not the type of book that I read, you know, I'm not interested in animals, but I think just again, I mean, you know, exposing yourself to different perspectives through reading is a very good way to like trigger different lines of thought. And like, theoretically, it's something that we should all be doing. And like, but it's something we could probably all be doing more, you know, or better. So. Yeah. Alrighty. I guess that's it for tonight. If you have any further thoughts on this, I'm always open to hearing it and hope this was valuable.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/Rabbi Schneeweis. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweis Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is @Matt-Schneeweis and my Zelle/Chase QuickPay and PayPal are MattSchneeweis@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor an article, shiur, or podcast episode, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at rabbischneeweis@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening, thank you to my readers for reading, and thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.